let's get started. Welcome everyone to the first episode of the London Aesthetics Forum this term, and thanks for coming even before term started, although I'm not surprised. It's my pleasure to welcome Kendall Walton, who's Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at University of Michigan and Visiting Professor of Philosophy at Stanford University. I'm sure you're all familiar with Ken's work. I'll just note three books. There are many, many articles. I cannot name them all. My Mises is Make-Believe, which is one of the most important books in philosophy of art, and more recently, collections of his papers, updated and revised with commentary, Marvelous Images from 2008, and In Other Shoes from 2014. I recommend you buy them both immediately. All right. So, Ken is going to talk to us about how to think about fiction and how not to. Thank you.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here, and thanks for coming. More than most of my writings, this talk is going to be a reaction against theories that I disagree with, as well as a defense of my own. The views that I object to are pretty obvious and widespread in the recent literature. I have in mind work by Gregory Curry, and especially his first book, The Nature of Fiction. He has changed some of his views since then, but I'll be talking mainly about his first book, which is continues to be influential. Also, Peter Lamarck, Stein Olsen, David Davies, Kathleen Stock, Rob Hopkins, and in connection with discussions of depiction, which are in some ways parallel or similar to those of fiction, there's Dom Lopez, Catherine Abel, Ben Blumsen, and so on, mainly those, I guess. I won't be very specific about my targets. For one thing, there's not enough time, and anyway, the point is not a philosophical prosecution. It's not a matter of who wins and who loses and so forth. All of the people I mentioned have contributed a great deal to our understanding of fiction, and what I object to are approaches to the topic which are, in any case, very plausible and tempting, even if they're dead wrong. So, and dead wrong things can often be very, very helpful. Anyway, three tendencies in much or most recent theoretical work on fiction, especially by philosophers, that we need to resist. They seem perfectly reasonable, innocuous at worst, but they have seriously limited, I think, and distorted our understanding of the Institute of Fiction. The first one is overemphasis on the notion of works of fiction and the distinction between fiction and nonfiction. Actually, those are two different points. Emphasis on the notion of works and distinguishing between works of fiction and works of nonfiction. Anyway, this is the usual starting point for accounts of the institution of fiction. Most recent theories begin by asking what works of fiction are and how they differ from works of nonfiction. Whether a literary work is a work of fiction or nonfiction is thought to be the most important, or at least the first question to be asked about it. I'm going to quote, give you a couple of quotes now. Curry from his first book: "There can hardly be a more important question about a piece of writing or speech than this: is it fiction or nonfiction?" And Lamarck and Olson: "The classification of narrative into fiction and nonfiction is of the utmost significance." I claim that a theory of fiction should focus first and primarily on the notion of fictional truth. What is it for a proposition to be fictional or to be true in a fictional world? The world of a story, or a novel, or movie, or picture, or in whatever other worlds like these there might be. The notion of truth in fiction is more central to the institution, more intimately involved in our understanding and appreciation of novels, pictures, and so on, than is anything like the ordinary notion of works of fiction, as opposed to works of nonfiction. Richard Garrick, I should mention Richard Garrick and Derek Metravers, also downplay the fiction-nonfiction distinction, so those guys are not my targets at this on this occasion, maybe another one. There will be other occasions. The second unfortunate tendency is the nearly exclusive focus on literature, on fictional uses of language, as opposed to fiction in other media. Most discussions focus on literary or verbal fiction, stories and novels, and so on. This, I think, is a strategic error. Limiting ourselves to literary fictions risks mistaking what makes them literary for what makes them fiction, and obscures more fundamental features that they share with fictions of other kinds. This would seem to have happened in a couple cases. I won't go into the details, and Gregory Curry in the first book, and also David Lewis, where the idea, the main problem seems to me to be in taking literary fiction as primary, that tends to make it seem as though all fictions have narrators, and I think it's quite clear that all fictions don't. Probably all literary fictions don't, but at least it's a lot more plausible to suppose that literary fictions do and others don't. Mark Sainsbury also, who is mainly interested in fictionalist metaphysical theories, declares that fictionalism will have little concern for nonverbal fictions, so we can confine our attention to verbal ones. But in some respects, it seems to me that verbal fictions are a misleading model for the best fictionalist accounts. I won't talk about that now, but we can later if you'd like. Anyway, there have to be limits, obviously, to the scope of an investigation. Life is short. We can't do everything at once. But choosing your limits is a substantive matter. The scope of a theory should be determined by the theory as it develops, not decided in advance. The third unfortunate tendency has been encouraged by the focus on literature, and that is taking fiction to be fundamentally a matter of communication. Works of fiction are said to be primarily, if not invariably, vehicles of communication, and some say this about pictures, pictorial representation as well. Some simply declare this to be so, declare fiction and or depiction to be primarily a matter of communication, as though it's obvious without an argument and without an explanation of what's meant by communication. I'm not saying that theorists overemphasize the role of fiction in communication. Novels and stories, for example, do often, maybe even usually, serve as vehicles of communication in just about any reasonable sense of that term. This is an important function that they often serve. The same goes for pictures. But building a notion of communication into an account of what fiction is essentially obscures more important and more fundamental properties that instances involving communication share with instances that do not. It's not surprising that those who start with the assumption that fiction or depiction is essentially a matter of communication give Gricean intentions, sometimes called communicative intentions, a central place in their theories. Typically, according to the usual views, some of them anyway, fiction makers Gricean intend that appreciators imagine the objects and events described in the text. To clarify, I assume you're probably familiar with the notion of Gricean intentions, but to clarify, an author Gricean intends that readers imagine that P, just in case she intends that they imagine that P, and also intends that they do so because she intends them to. Okay, come back to that. Several recent authors introduce a notion of fictive utterances, illocutionary actions performed with Gricean intentions that appreciators imagine or make believe what they say or what they write. Kathleen Stock, I'm going to quote a little bit here, Kathleen Stock, acknowledging the lead of Curry and Lamarck and Olson, puts it this way: necessarily, fictive utterance is intended by its utterer to prescribe imagining, the intention being Gricean, that is, the utterer of P must intend not just that the reader or hearer will imagine that P, but also that she does so as a result of recognizing the utterer's intention that she do so. What is it to be a work of fiction is then explained in terms of fictive utterances. And I should mention that Curry backed off a little bit later from this view, so I'm going to only talk about his earlier view. fiction and nonfiction. The notion of works of fiction and the fiction-nonfiction distinction play a less central role in the institution of fiction than that of truth and fiction does, as I already said. One preliminary consideration, we dismiss questions about a work's status as fiction or nonfiction more readily than we do questions about whether propositions are fictional. Is Truman Capote's In Cold Blood fiction or nonfiction? All this is said to be a puzzle case. Stacy thinks it's obvious that it's nonfiction, whatever. Anyway, a reasonable answer to this question and other similar questions for many purposes is whatever, take your pick, doesn't much matter how we classify it. We will be interested in various circumstances that are sometimes thought to bear on the decision, however. We will be interested in whether some or many sentences in a work, literary work, say, are true, whether they are meant to be true, whether the author believes them, whether readers are expected to believe them, whether readers care about whether they are true or should care about this, and so forth and so on. Those are all things that we are often very important to think about. But we may nevertheless pass on the question of how these circumstances add up, whether possessing them makes a work fiction or nonfiction. On reflection, we notice that none of these circumstances or their combination cleanly distinguishes fiction from nonfiction in anything like the ordinary sense of these terms. This is old news, I think. Sentences in either paradigmatic literary fictions or paradigmatic nonfictions may be either true or false. Some of them are true, some of them are false in both cases. The author may or may not believe them, may or may not purport to believe them. The author may or may not be asserting them or intend readers to believe them or Grice intend them to believe, and so on. And it may or may not be reasonable or appropriate to criticize the author if her sentences are not true or if she doesn't believe them. All of those things are true in both cases of fiction, literary fictions, and literary nonfictions. And in either case, the author might imply, call attention to, thoughts or ideas that she does not express explicitly, and she may or may not be claiming them to be true or hoping to convince readers that they are true, and so forth and so on. There's no need to belabor these points. I illustrated a lot of them in Chapter 2 of Mimesis, and lots of other people have made similar points in other places. But it's enough to remind ourselves of various familiar literary genre or subgenre of fiction and nonfiction. Lamarck himself gives us a useful list. Among customarily classified fictions, there are historical fictions, moral or philosophical fictions, novels and movies that are based on real events, nonfiction novels, other realistic fictions, other quote realistic fictions meant and expected to be accurate portrayals of certain aspects of the real world. There are more or less fantastic fictions and science fiction which are expected to get certain things right, geographical facts, for instance, historical settings, human psychology, and so forth. Stacy Friend points out that works of fiction don't constitute a natural kind. She and Curry also, in 2014, both suggest that fiction and nonfiction be understood as cluster concepts, that various different features count in favor of something's being a work of fiction, but we add them up using probably a more or less arbitrary weightings, you know, when we add them up and try to decide whether a particular work counts as fiction or counts as nonfiction. The ordinary notion of fiction and work of fiction, and also that of nonfiction, is much like that of art or work of art. Both concepts, having evolved over the ages in various accidental ways, apply to a diverse hodgepodge of entities. And it's arguable in both cases that some cultures, the ancients, various non-Western cultures or whatever, lack these notions and or don't recognize the distinction between fiction and nonfiction or between art and non-art. Stacy says that it's plausible to say that the conventions for writing nonfiction history have changed in time because in earlier days, history included some things that we usually would allow only in fiction. I suggest that it might be better today to say that certain historical writings haven't been classified as fiction or nonfiction. What is more recent, I suggest, is the distinction between fiction and nonfiction, the recognition of those genres. And I think in some cultures there probably is no established practice of classifying them. We do recognize a distinction between, we do now in our culture, recognize a distinction between fiction and nonfiction, however messy and confused and arbitrary it might be, and it certainly does play a substantial role in current and recent Western literary cultures. As Friend and others have pointed out, whether a recent text is labeled, classified as fiction or as nonfiction affects how we understand and respond to it. This is probably what Curry and Lamarck and Olson had in mind. The label helps to determine which of the propositions that are stated in or implied by the text are understood to be asserted by the author, which are expected to be true, and so on. This probably depends or often depends on what subgenre of fiction or nonfiction the text belongs to, what kind of fiction it is or what kind of nonfiction it is, and that might be evident from features of the text itself once it's classified as fiction or as nonfiction. Truth in fiction. The notion of truth in fiction, in contrast to that of works of fiction, is at the very center of our understanding of, and appreciation of things like novels, stories, pictures of unicorns, and so on. We have to be concerned with truth in fiction. Understanding and appreciation can't get started unless we think about what it is or what is or is not true in a fictional world, in the world of the work. Sometimes it's hard to decide. Sometimes there may be no fact of the matter, no correct answer. But questions about what is or isn't fictional are crucial, probably the starting points of our activity as readers or appreciators. So we cannot simply dismiss these questions as we might the question, sometimes the question of whether a work is fiction or nonfiction, when we say it doesn't matter how we classify it. We have to consider, think about what is true in the fiction. What is it? What is truth in fiction? What is it for a proposition to be fictional? In Mimesis and elsewhere, I said that fictional propositions are propositions that are to be imagined. More exactly, a proposition P is fictional in the world of a given work W, just in case there is a prescription to a prescription or a mandate applicable to appreciators of that work to imagine P should the question arise. So to be fictional, I suggested, is for there to be a prescription that one imagine the proposition in question. I've come to realize that this is only half right. Prescriptions to imagine are necessary but not sufficient for fictionality. I won't go over my reasons for that now, but I want, there are various kinds of counterexamples to the notion that prescription to imagine is sufficient for a proposition being fictional in a given work. But now I want to think about counterexamples of it, or possible counterexamples of different kind, different from the ones I discussed before. Lots of standardly recognized paradigmatic works of nonfiction, works that arguably don't even have fictional worlds, prescribe imaginings. I realized only gradually as I was working on these things how prevalent such prescriptions are, as I discovered bits and pieces of make-believe or pretense all over the place in many different contexts. Stacy Friend and others have mentioned lots of other cases as well. Histories, biographies, and astronomy textbooks, as well as novels and stories, sometimes contain vivid visual descriptions. There's metaphor, irony, hyperbole, counterfactuals, thought experiments, quotation, and so forth, free and direct discourse, all of which plausibly, or at least on some views, involve a certain sort of make-believe. And in many cases, it would seem that readers or viewers are prescribed to imagine certain propositions in reading a paradigmatically non-fictional work, for instance. They're prescribed to imagine certain propositions, which, however, are not fictional in the world of the work, perhaps because there is no such world. Stacy mentions Ernest Shackleton's South, and she also mentions, this is an example that doesn't work. I am arguing against you.
That's all right.
That's okay. William Hazlitt, I mentioned in Mimesis about 1,000 years ago, I don't remember where exactly, that William Hazlitt's characters of Shakespeare's plays, that book is largely about mere fictions, yet, I think there's a quotation from me, nothing is more unambiguously a work of nonfiction. But then, as Stacy points out, later on in Mimesis, which I wrote only maybe 1,000 years ago, not a couple, I claim that discussions of fictional characters involves make-believe, and she says it calls for us to imagine that there are such characters. So Hazlitt's book should count qualify as a work of fiction in my special sense, at least it generates fictional truths. Actually, though, the make-believe that it calls for is prop-oriented make-believe, and I won't go into the details about that, but prop-oriented make-believe is a kind of make-believe where we don't necessarily participate in the make-believe, if we participated in the make-believe that it involves, we would be prescribed to imagine certain things, but to understand the references to fictional characters and so forth, we don't have to participate. We have to recognize the make-believe, we don't have to participate. So I don't think it's so clear that in Hazlitt's book we are prescribed to imagine things. But this is just because she's next to me, I have a chance to make this, to suggest this. But anyway, the general point, of course, is that, yes, there are lots of prescribed imaginings, imaginings that are prescribed for people who try to read and understand traditional works of nonfiction. However, another point I think needs to be made, and that is this. There are philosophical or scientific thought experiments which are often fictions and which may prescribe imaginings. And there are also illustrative fables and stories in a book of moral instruction and so forth. And in this case, we do have fictionality, but not fictionality in a world of the work as a whole. So if there's a thought experiment, then maybe the appreciator of the thought experiment, the reader of the thought experiment, is prescribed to imagine certain things. And what that person is prescribed to imagine are propositions probably that are fictional in the world of the thought experiment, but the world of the thought experiment is not the same as the world of the work as a whole. Okay. Anyway, prescriptions to imagine are necessary for fictionality, even if not sufficient, and the necessity is what matters for present purposes. What are prescriptions? I haven't said nearly enough about the notion of a prescription or a mandate, that is the normative aspect of fictionality. And by the way, I say prescribe or mandate, some go with something like invite or even prompt or encourage, to say that we are invited or prompted or encouraged to imagine certain things doesn't give us the normative aspect. I don't think invitations are clearly is clearly a normative notion. So I think it's important to understand this in terms of something stronger, prescription or mandate, which I take to be normative. I'll focus on the notion of prescription now, putting aside questions about imagination, about what is prescribed. Theories that don't give imagining the central role that I do might still rely on a notion of prescription. Richard Volheim's account of pictorial representation includes a normative content as what he calls a standard of correctness for seeing in. Certain things are to be seen in a pictorial design and so forth, although he denies that this is even partly a matter of imagining. What is it for an imagination to be prescribed, that is, for a norm to be in force? This is not the place to offer a theory of normativity, fortunately, because I am certainly not able to do that. I will make a couple of observations, which I think are simple and uncontroversial enough for our purposes. First, there's no normativity without people. The fact that a prescription is in force is, I think, a fact about people. Then what fact about people is it? Here's a first stab. I'm sure it won't work in the long run, but it may be pointing in the right direction. The fact about people is a fact about their dispositions. When people are fully aware of the relevant circumstances, dispositions to respond to behavior in certain ways, to accept some as appropriate or proper and fitting, and to reject others. These dispositions may result from explicit agreements about what sorts of things are proper, or there may be implicit understandings arising from common experiences, shared traditions, practices of a given social group, and perhaps hardwired tendencies of one sort or another. Also, prescriptions are in force for a particular social group or in a particular social context. So fictionality is relative to a social group or context. The group or context may be large or small. It may be temporary or permanent. A norm may be in force, and an object may generate a fictional truth relative to Western civilization since the Renaissance, or even relative to the entire human race. Or it may be in force just relative to a small group of friends on a lazy afternoon. This distinction will be of different kinds of social groups that something may be a prescription relative to will be very important as we go on. Prescriptions to imagine can be based on artists' intentions, even on Gricean intentions. There might be an understanding, even an explicit one, that appreciators are to imagine whatever an author or artist intends them to imagine, or even whatever the artist Grice intends them to imagine. So appreciators may be disposed to approve of or accept imaginings that conform to these intentions. Call an artist's intention when this is so the ground of the prescriptions. But notice that intentions, even Gricean intentions, are not themselves sufficient for normativity, for fictionality on my account. There could be an understanding in a social group that filmmakers' intentions, Gricean or plain, about what is to imagine are to be ignored. There could be a convention that you ignore whatever the artist intended you to imagine. So if what made propositions fictional were just intentions or just Gricean intentions, there could be fictionality without prescriptions to imagine. And that would be bad. Prescriptions are what really matter. Accounts of fictionality based merely on intentions do not get to the heart of things. They miss what's important about fictionality. Several of the philosophers I mentioned take Gricean intentions to be central to their accounts of works of fiction. Actually, I already said that. And they usually explain that in terms of a notion of fictive utterance. They're not always explicit about what they take fictional truth to be, but it's clear, I think, for most, maybe all of them, that propositional fictionality depends in one way or another on fiction makers' Gricean intentions, sometimes indirectly and so on. Those who emphasize Gricean intentions in their understanding of fictionality may agree with me that prescriptions to imagine are necessary for fictionality. So the role of Gricean intentions is, I think, in many cases, to ground the prescriptions. Several seem to think, however, that intentions are the only possible ground of prescriptions, or at least they neglect to consider other possibilities. One might retreat to a weaker view on which the intentions crucial for fictionality need not be Gricean. Richard Wolheim's account of depiction illustrates this nicely. His account includes a clear normative component, as I said, a standard of correctness for seeing things in visual designs, which is based solidly on artists' intentions. The quote from Volheim, "The standard of correctness for seeing in is set by the intentions of the artist insofar as they are fulfilled." But these are simple intentions. Volheim clearly does not have Gricean intentions in mind. In fact, he seems to suggest that Gricean intentions are not involved. Here's a quotation then from Volheim. "It's not necessary that a spectator of a picture should, in order to see a given representation appropriately, actually draw upon the standard of correctness. He does not, in seeing what the picture represents, have to do so through first recognizing that this is or was the artist's intention. On the contrary, he may reconstruct the artist's intention from what is visible to him in the picture. When the viewer sees certain things in a picture, he doesn't do so because the artist intended him to, so presumably artists don't ordinarily intend viewers to see them as a result of recognizing their intentions. The artist induces the viewer to see such and such in the design by creating a design of a sort that will trigger the seeing in. The role of the intention is to render this seeing in correct or proper, that is, prescribed." A theory of fictionality might have it that fictional propositions are to be imagined, this prescription being grounded in a simple non-Gricean intentions. Then we could say that readers or viewers imagine certain things for whatever reason, perhaps simply because the text or the marks on a picture surface more or less automatically induce the imagining, but not necessarily because they recognize the fiction maker's intention that we imagine certain things, but that the correctness of these imagines, the prescriptions to imagine as they do, may be what are determined by authors' or artists' intentions, plain intentions, that we imagine what we do. So in this view, the fiction maker induces imaginings simply by arranging the words of the text or the marks on a surface on a picture surface so as to elicit those imaginings, but she does not necessarily expect appreciators to imagine as she wants them to because that is what she wants them or intends. Norms certainly do not, in general, have to be grounded on anyone's intentions, let alone Gricean intentions, nor must they be established by anyone's deliberate action. Think of merited responses, for instance, laughter in response to something that is in fact funny, where it's prescribed that we laugh, pitying what is pitiable, embarrassment about what is embarrassing, and so forth. There are norms of proper English grammar. There are ethical norms. There are even norms of etiquette, and so forth, most of which are almost certainly not based on anyone's intentions of any sort. One recent author, Ben Blumsen, in a spirited and inventive defense of giving Gricean intentions a central role in understanding pictures, seems to disagree. After citing approvingly Curry's account of fiction in terms of Gricean intentions, he remarks that, quote, "similarly, jokes are utterances intended by means of recognition of intention to induce amusement." I think that's maybe even more clear if we rearrange it a bit. Jokes are utterances intended to induce amusement by means of recognition of intention. But surely a jokester does not usually intend or expect listeners to laugh because of her intention that they laugh, let alone because of the Gricean intention. She wants them to laugh because her joke is funny, and she does her best to make it funny. Displaying one's intention that people laugh might ruin the joke. A straight face is often more effective. After realizing that it's funny, we may infer that the jokester intended us to laugh, but that wasn't almost certainly our reason for laughing or why we laugh. And in this case, intentions do not seem to come into the picture even as grounds for norms. for the appropriateness or propriety of the amusement. Whether laughter is merited depends on whatever features of the joke make it funny. I understand norms, prescriptions to imagine, however they are grounded, to be what is necessary for truth in fiction, for the fictionality of propositions. This allows me to say, as I did, that in a particular social context, clouds or patterns of cracks in rocks can prescribe imaginings and generate fictional truths. Think, for example, of cracks in rocks that, by chance, spell out, once upon a time, there were three bears or something or other. Suppose that happens entirely by chance. And I suggested that in a certain situation, this might generate fictional truths. There might be a prescription to imagine certain things in response to this, these cracks in the rock, and then there would be fictional truths. No intentions, Gricean or otherwise, are needed, although the relevant norms do have to be in effect. And this goes for monkey-typed texts and, even more realistically, computer-generated stories or pictures and so forth. I mentioned a situation in which friends are lolling around in a meadow, gazing at the sky. There might be an explicit or tacit understanding in this very small social context that they are to imagine whatever it is that a given cloud looks like, what they most easily and naturally see in it from their perspective in the meadow. They might argue. One might say, look at that bear, pointing to the sky. The other, that isn't a bear, it's a walrus. Don't you see the tusks? One of them might launch the game simply by participating in it out of the blue, for example, by saying, look at that bear. And this might, in this context, suffice to establish the conditional prescription in this very local context to imagine whatever it is that that and other clouds look like. The speaker might intend that her friends do these imaginings, but she need not have any such intention for the prescription to be in force. The clouds generate fictional truths if the right sort of prescription actually is in force, however it's grounded, but only in this very small and very temporary social context. It's only relative to this context that the fictional truths are generated. And it might be perfectly appropriate and true to say that the clouds do not depict bears or walruses or anything else, that they do not generate fictional truths, if we have in mind a larger social context, for example, one relative to which the paintings of Caravaggio and Vermeer and Manet and Cézanne are depictions. If we have in mind that larger context, then it might be perfectly true to say that the clouds do not depict bears or walruses and so forth, because the prescriptions are not in force relative to this larger social context. But nevertheless, they may be in force relative to the small one. I won't say very much about communication. How are we doing?
Doing fine.
Okay, so far. My main objection to taking fiction to be essentially a matter of communication consists in what I've already said about the inessentiality of Gricean intentions, so-called communicative intentions. And again, I certainly do not deny that communication is often involved. And the kids looking at the clouds might be understood as communicating with one another, though perhaps not in as strong a sense as that in which, for example, a parent tells the story of the boy who cried wolf in order to instruct her children. The social group, just one small point about this, the social group relative to which fiction happens can consist of just one person. I might, by myself, resolve to imagine whatever the clouds most naturally look to me like and decide to count these imaginings as prescribed. So I might tell myself, after looking more closely at a cloud, I was wrong in thinking that it's bare, it's really a walrus. This is, I take it, full-fledged fictionality. It is fictional, relative to this very minimal social context, one person, that there is a walrus, but is a communication, well, in a most intense sense, at best. Other things to be said, but and of course we have to think more about exactly what we mean by communication. Curry, again in his early book, insists on distinguishing between something's being a work of fiction and it's merely being treated as if it is fiction, and others have echoed this distinction as well. David Davies, I believe. Curry says, at most we can treat the shapes on the rock, the cracks on the rock or whatever, as if they were fiction, respond to them as we would to a fictional work. This does not make them fiction, he says. Otherwise, the Bible would be a work of fiction, since many people read and enjoy Bible stories as fiction. Quote, what makes the Bible nonfiction, if that's what it is exactly the absence of the right kind of intention on the part of authors. Just about anything can be read as fiction, but not everything is fiction. Curry is concerned here with the notion of works of fiction versus nonfiction. Our interest now is in fictional truth. In a similar spirit, one might, and maybe Curry would or would have then, I'm not sure, but in a similar spirit, one might insist on distinguishing between propositional fictionality and as-if propositional fictionality. So we might say something like this. We might treat the words of the Bible as if they make it fictional that Adam and Eve lived in the Garden of Eden, for instance. We might respond to these words as we would if they did generate fictional truths, but the argument would go, they do not. But if there are people who not only imagine in response to the sentences in the Bible, but in certain circumstances, think of this as the appropriate or proper way of responding to it, it seems perfectly reasonable to say that for them, in those circumstances, it does generate fictional truths about Adam and Eve, for instance. And likewise for clouds, cracks in the rocks, and so forth. Is this just a matter of terminology, a trivial verbal difference? Actually, Curry almost suggests as much, but it's not for a couple of related reasons. Prescriptions to imagine are absolutely crucial components of the institution of fiction, irrespective of how they are grounded. It often matters little whether intentions or something else are responsible for the prescriptions. Theories that highlight the distinction between intention-grounded prescriptions and other prescriptions put the emphasis in the wrong place. Recognition that certain imaginings are prescribed and others not is a central ingredient of the experience of being caught up in a story, being immersed in a fiction, responding to the fiction in some ways much like the way we respond to real-world events. The role of the prescriptions in such experience is familiar, I think. The following is mostly very old news. Appreciators can be ignorant or mistaken about what is fictional, as we can about the real world. This is so because what is fictional depends partly on there being prescriptions to imagine certain propositions when props of certain kinds are present. We have to discover what is fictional, the content of a fictional world, by discovering features of the props, and sometimes we are surprised. It doesn't matter whether intentions have anything to do with these prescriptions. What is important is just that there are prescriptions, however grounded, prescriptions to engage in certain imaginings given the nature of props. Moreover, what we discover to be fictional is to be imagined, just as what is true is to be believed. What exactly imagining is a matter of dispute, but many recognize that it's importantly analogous to believing. Curry thinks of imagining as simulating belief. I have suggested that imagining a proposition in the ways they are interested in anyway includes imagining believing it. Either way, thanks to the fact that prescriptions to imagine are necessary for fictionality, our relationship to the content of fictional worlds is much like our relationship to the real world. This also has a lot to do with the experience of being caught up in the story, of responding to it much as we would to actual real-world events. Again, there's nothing about any of this that requires fiction makers' intentions, much less Gricean intentions. If intentions establish the connection between props and fictional truths, if they ground prescriptions to imagine, fine. But the prescriptions themselves do the job, however they are grounded. And recall that there could be a convention to the effect that what fiction makers intend appreciators to imagine is not to be imagined and is not fictional. Of course, we are sometimes interested, for one reason or another, in what a fiction maker meant to do, including what she intended us to imagine. But often the importance of fiction makers' intentions is only, or at least primarily, to ground prescriptions to imagine, and that suffices for our immersion in the fiction. We may not know or care what grounds the prescriptions. The question may not arise. Indeed, there may not even be a fact of the matter. Cloud formations and cracks in rocks, in the special social context I described, are like novels and nursery rhymes in the unicorn tapestries, in that they generate fictional truths consisting in part of prescriptions to imagine, relative to a larger or a smaller social context, of course. Same with computer-generated stories and pictures and so forth. An adequate theory of fiction must recognize and underline this similarity. The important distinction, then, is one that Curry, the early Curry anyway, and others do not recognize, not explicitly anyway, is whether or not there is a prescription, however grounded, to imagine certain propositions. In the cases mentioned, appreciators or participants do not just happen to decide to imagine these things in a deliberate daydream. They are required to, just as belief is demanded for things that are true. This distinction between whether or not there is a prescription, however grounded, this distinction is far more fundamental, far more central in the relevant human practices than Curry's distinction between fictionality and as-if fictionality, i.e. the distinction between prescriptions grounded in intentions and prescriptions grounded otherwise. There's still another reason. I'm almost done. There's still another reason to reject Curry's claim that, quote, at most we can treat the shapes in the rock as if they were fiction. This implies that in situations like the ones I described, we regard the shapes, we think of them, as having been produced with the Grice intention of inducing imagining, even though we know better. There's no reason to think that we must so regard them in order to be caught up in the story, or even that we are likely to. We might as well say that when intentions do ground prescriptions, when we read a novel, perhaps, we treat the prescriptions as if they are grounded on something else, something other than intentions. One final point. Can there be fictionality or truth in fiction without works of fiction? That is, can there be propositions that are true in a world without works whose worlds they are? It seems to me that that's perfectly possible. It may be true in the case of clouds and rock cracks and so forth. But you can, if you disagree with that, you can still hardly deny that we do, in the case of children's make-believe, have fictionality, that is, fictional worlds in which certain propositions are fictional, without a work of fiction at all, without a work. Of course, that depends to some extent on what we mean by a work, but it certainly is not a work of fiction defined in the way people have tended to do so, that is, a result of fictive utterances, as a result of an act of storytelling. There is no act of storytelling that establishes the fictional world. So we have here still another reason to focus first and primarily on the notion of truth in fiction, rather than the notion of works of fiction, or of works, period. The notion of truth in fiction has broader scope than that of works of fiction, enabling us to see similarities between instances of fictionality that do and ones that do not involve works of fiction. And then, of course, we can examine the differences within this larger class of cases, one difference being that some of them involve works and others do not. Thank you.